Our Universalist and Unitarian women of the last centuries have had one virtue in common. They have been pioneers. These women who have literally made history were not outstanding persons who happened to be Unitarians or Universalists in their religion. Not at all. It was their dynamic religious liberalism which made them great. Our Unitarian and Universalist religion was an ethical leaven, and the result was an era of feminine foment. Don and Marcia are going to light the chalice. A wise person once said, "Take from the past not its ashes, but its fire." Today we kindle this flame, knowing that our presence forms a bridge between the past and the future. Please join in the words in your program. May the flame we light today in our hearts, for its strength of our heritage, may it empower us to act boldly for justice in the present world, and may it shine brightly in our lives as a beacon for future generations.
Good morning. Boy, that was a little loud. Sorry, let me try that again. Good morning. So there are many times where I wish I could stay and hear the sermon, and this week in particular, because we very rarely hear about famous Unitarian Universalist women. And I just finished a class on UU history and polity, and maybe heard about one woman. Yet there are many women that did many famous things. And today we happen to have four of those women with us, and they're going to read us a little biography. Their names are here. I decided to do the names. Judith Sargent Murray, Margaret Fuller, Lucy Stone, and Mary Livermore. But I need four kids to come up and just hold some pictures for me. So how about Nathan, James, Henry, and who else? Do you want to do it? Alex? Come on up. It's just to hold pictures. So what we're going to do is these four women are going to read their biographies. The names are on the back of their pictures. Do not tell anyone these names. So the women are going to read their biography, and these people here are after they... Thank you guys for just coming up, because I know this is not your comfort zone for all of you. They're going to read their biography, and then someone from the congregation is going to guess which one of these names they think match. Now, on the back, when they guess, you're going to go and take this... So you don't tell... So if this picture, if this is the name they guess, you're going to go stand in front of that woman. So can we have our four visitors come on up, please? They are Judith Sargent Murray, Margaret Fuller, Lucy Stone, and Mary Livermore in no particular order. They're going to come right over here in the front, actually. And they're going to read their biography. And don't peek at the answers. Okay, so would you introduce yourself, please? I mean, don't introduce yourself. Ah.
I was born in 1818 on a farm near West Brookfield. We went to the Congregational Church. One day I was reading the Bible, and I, quote, was filled with horror, end quote. I knew the law and the customs were against women, but it never occurred to me that God could be against women, too. The first time I spoke up in public was at church. The congregation was deciding if it should ask a member who was working to end slavery to leave the church. I raised my hand to vote no, and was told my vote didn't count because I was a woman. I wanted to go to college, but my father wouldn't pay for a girl to go, so I had to work as a school teacher for 10 years before I could afford it. I went to the only college open to women, Oberlin College in Ohio. That's where I became a Unitarian. When I came back home, I found out I was the first woman from Massachusetts to graduate from college. I decided I had to do something to change the laws that gave men power over women and allowed slavery to continue. So I gave speeches all over the country. I traveled by train, stagecoach, and horse-drawn carriage and met with women every place I went. I knew if enough women spoke up, eventually we would get our rights, including the right to vote. Do you know who I am?
Great. Do we have a contestant that's ready to guess? Who do you think that was? Judith Sargent Murray, Margaret Fuller, Lucy Stone, or Mary Livermore? You think it's Lucy Stone. Okay, Lucy Stone can go stand right in front of this person. Okay, we'll see at the end if we have a match. All right, you're up next.
Okay. I was born in Gloucester in 1751. My father was in the shipping business and fought in the Revolution alongside George Washington at Valley Forge. My mother's family had plenty of money, so we had an easy life. Most girls didn't go to school, but I learned to read and write and read everything I could find. But because I was a girl, I was not allowed to study with my brother or go to Harvard College. I didn't think it was fair that he got more education than me just because he was a boy. When I was 19, my father discovered Universalism and invited John Murray to come visit. I knew right away that this was the religion for me. In fact, I believed in this religion so much that I helped start the first Universalist church in America. Later, I was asked to write a book about children's religious education. In the introduction, I made sure to mention how I believed that boys and girls should be able to both gain knowledge. In 1970, I wrote the very first essay on women's rights published in America. It was called On the Equality of the Sexes. Over 196 words. Do you know who I am?
They think it's Judith Sargent Murray. So who has that? Okay, so you can go stand in front of Pat. Now Janet's going to read us the next biography.
I was born in 1820 in Boston. At an early age, I asked questions about my family's Baptist religion, especially their belief that some people were saved and others not. When I was 7 and my baby sister was born, I begged my parents to see no chance of her not being saved. When I died before she was baptized, I was shocked that my parents believed my little baby sister had died unsaved. I told them right then and there I would rather go to hell and be with my sister than go to heaven with a God that would allow an innocent baby to spend eternity in torment. I was so depressed about my sister that my parents sent me to Virginia to teach children who lived on a plantation and had slaves. I found out what a horrible system slavery was and wrote about it in a book called The Story of My Life. When I came back home, I discovered Universalism and married a Universalist minister, Daniel Livermore. We moved to Chicago, where I started giving public speeches during the Civil War. I helped organize thousands of local aid societies after seeing the war firsthand when I went to the battlefield to help injured soldiers. After the war, we came back to Boston and bought a house in Melrose. I traveled from coast to coast into Europe and gave more than 3,000 speeches about women's rights and the importance of full education for girls. They called me the queen of the platform. Do you know who I am?
This is a tough one. Who do you think that might be?
Mary.
Mary Livermore. Okay, who's Mary? All right, you can go stand in front of Janet. And last but not least.
You just have to pretend you don't know who this is.
Well, we don't know if everyone's right other than perhaps Mary.
Oh, you're right. Okay, good. I was born in 1810 in Cambridge. My parents had good educations, but not much money. They joined one of the first Unitarian churches, so that's how I was raised. My mother loved to grow beautiful flowers, and my father was in politics, serving first in the Massachusetts Senate and later in the Congress. I loved to learn, and when I was 3, my father taught me to read. At age 5, I learned arithmetic and Latin. I only went to school for a couple of years, but I got an excellent education from my father and just because I loved to learn on my own. When I was a teenager, I started teaching my younger siblings and later helped young men prepare to go to Harvard. This was pretty good considering that educating girls was not considered very important. I was frustrated by the lack of opportunities for women to learn and have interesting jobs, so I started what I called conversations. I invited women to meet in groups and read, think, and speak about their ideas. I also wrote a really important book called Women in the 19th Century. Some women in New York read it and then held the first women's rights convention in Seneca Falls. I am really proud that I made a difference in helping women get their rights. Do you know who I am?
All right. Who do you think this might be? Margaret Fuller, is that who you have? All right. Now, let's see how well we did. Henry, who is this picture?
Lucy Stone.
Is that a match?
I'm Lucy Stone.
Oh, awesome. And who do you have?
Judith Sargent Murray.
Is that a match?
I am Judith Sargent Murray.
And we already know that this is Mary Livermore. And who do you have? Can you read my writing? Because it's really fancy. Fuller. Yeah, Margaret Fuller. And are you a match?
I am Margaret Fuller.
You guys give yourselves a round of applause. That was awesome. All right, and I do want to mention one thing that you'll notice. The system is really loud today, so I'm sorry if I'm sounding too loud. I'm going to pull this away. That how many of these women, their main priority was to get education. And a lot of times I know kids, including myself, sometimes are like, you know, why do we have to go to school? It's so boring. I wish I could stay home all day. But if you... thank you, that was perfect. If you had a chance to never get educated, if you wanted to learn and you were told you cannot because you're a boy, I'm sorry, you can't have a job because you're a boy. Oh, I'm sorry, you wanted a career? Oh, I'm sorry, James, you can't have that. You're a boy. Oh, and Alex, you want to go and live on your own? I'm sorry, you're a boy, you can't do that. We would think that was kind of crazy. And these women did. They thought it was kind of... So, say that again. Well, they did have a life, and all of these women fought against the restrictions that were put on them by society. Yet, we don't know very many of their names, but some of you really did, and I was impressed. So I want to thank you for participating, and when you hear these names, be proud of the fact that they, especially the women and the girls here, be proud of the fact that they set the base for a lot of what happened that eventually gave the women in our country the rights to so many different rights, including the right to vote, to have your own money, to live on your own, to be educated. All right, thank you. Thank you to all for participating.
Our meditation this morning comes from an early 20th century Unitarian minister, Reverend Anita Truman Pickett. She served congregations mostly in Massachusetts for 45 years, serving as summer minister in Roe. She helped found Roe Camp. Have any of you ever been to Roe? It's a wonderful place. So I'm going to read her confession of faith, because she shares her understanding of what the divine is. And in the silence that follows, I invite you to consider how you describe your own sense of faith. So let us enter into a spirit of meditation as we hear this confession of faith. The divine self has created within its being many separate selves, that in each it may enfold a revealer and a beholder of its own perfection. I am one of these separate selves, and I follow my destiny. Every day is a romantic adventure. Every place I visit is holy ground. All persons I meet are divine companions, seeking me as I seek them, that we may reveal the divine in our souls to one another and share the divine that we discover in our universe. To realize and reveal the divine within my soul, to see, serve, and worship the divine in all else. This is my life, my faith, my religion.
Hi, my name's Rebecca Sedolnik, and I've been coming to church here for about 18 years. My husband Joe and I first started attending because we were looking for a place to get married. And after our wedding, we attended for a couple of years, but we really didn't get very involved. At the time, we were both working full-time, and we had a fairly large group of friends that we spent a lot of our time with on the weekends. And we didn't really feel the need to connect to the church community besides attending services on Sundays. When we had our first child, we decided to take a little break from the church until he was old enough to participate in the religious education program and get something out of the church experience, too. At that time, people called canvassers would call folks to talk to them about pledging for the stewardship campaign. And I remember getting a call from a canvasser who was obviously surprised when I said we planned to contribute. They must have thought we were a lost cause because we weren't really attending anymore. I told them, they asked why we stick, which I thought was a question for a canvasser. But they were obviously curious. And I said, I appreciated this church being here when we got married, and I wanted it to be here when we were ready to come back. And I'll never forget how shocked that person was. And I'll never regret the decision that we made to continue to contribute, because a lot changed while we were away. The church went through the process of welcoming a new minister, and things changed for us. The people in our group of friends, a lot of them got married, some of them started having kids, and it became harder and harder for us to get together. With the birth of our second child, I decided to leave my job as a medical writer and just focus more on being a mom, and I spent a lot more time at home and on my own. So, even though my biggest motivation for returning to church was to give my kids a chance to experience a religious education program, which is something I didn't have much chance to do as a child, I had no idea how important coming here would turn out to be for me. I'm an introvert, if you can't tell by how much fun I'm having up here. And I came from a very small church. My family was half of the congregation. So the idea of a church being your source of community was kind of new to me. I thought of it more as an educational thing. And coffee hour was my idea of torture. But as I started making personal connections, first through volunteering in the RE program and later through helping with the Apple Pie Project and the craft and jewelry table at the fair, I found that even an introvert like me can make connections and become comfortable in a larger community. And I've gained a greater understanding of how important those connections can be. I still exchange holiday cards with all my former coworkers, well, not all of them, but with former coworkers and lots of our friends from the past. But those people are not directly involved in our lives the way people from this church are. And until recently, I didn't have any family in Massachusetts. But this church has been my local family, and we've shared in each other's joys and sorrows. This church, this community of people, supports each other and does what it can to support people outside of this church as well. Everyone who contributes to financially sustain this church helps make that magic happen. And it helps make sure that this church is here when people are ready to connect and become a part of this community. I hope that each of you finds something in this church that nurtures and supports you, and that you can find a way to help sustain it so it will be here to nurture and support others.
That was a wonderful story. Thank you. Another part of our weekly worship is inviting you to contribute. And my favorite words for the offering are the idea that we have drunk from wells we did not dig, and we have been warmed by fires we did not build. And so it's to make that link between all that we have received and all that we have and that all that we might be able to share with others. I also think it's a wonderful thing that part of the non-pledge donations made during the offering is shared with the community. That's another really important aspect. So I invite you to give what you can, and those who can, maybe give just a little bit more. Thank you. More than 100 years ago, in what was then the New Beacon Religious Education Program, Ella Lyman Cabot wrote, "We sometimes speak as if the past were over and done with. That's past. That's out of date. That's ended. Yet, try to obliterate in your thought all that is past. It's impossible, of course, because in so doing, we obliterate ourselves. Without the help of what we call the past, we could not live at all. The past, instead of being done with, is, then, the real fiber of the world as we know it. Just as the food we eat nourishes us till it becomes what we act with, the past is always what we think with. The past is always what we think with." So here we are in the second decade of the 21st century, with its wars and its economic and environmental challenges, and this past we think with is missing major pieces about women and about other groups of people who were part of our history. How can we think about ways to create a better future when we're missing key elements of the toolkit we need to think with? As Unitarian Universalists, we cannot understand our faith tradition unless we know the wisdom and the stories of both women and men who stand before us in this great heritage. What meaning did these liberal religious faiths have for them? What spiritual insights led them to choose or maintain their faith? And how did these religious perspectives inform their lives? Today, I've chosen four of the many women it has been my privilege to come to know through my work with the Women's Heritage Society and also editing the book that you'll see out at coffee hour, Standing Before Us, Unitarian Universalist Women and Social Reform, 1776 to 1936. So, and it just happens that all four of these women are from Massachusetts. But there were lots of women from other places, too. But it's kind of nice to know about the homegrown women, right? So the first two women I'm going to talk about provided the spiritual and intellectual motivation for a major shift in thinking concerning the relationship between the sexes. The other two used this understanding to provide leadership in what became known as the women's suffrage movement. This movement led to the passage of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, acknowledging women's right to vote. I don't like to say granting. I like to say acknowledging, because I think we had the right all along. We just, the guys weren't letting us have it. So today we take this right for granted and forget that it was less than 100 years ago that more than 70 years of organized effort culminated in the passage of that amendment. And so if any of you think about not voting, just remember 70 years of work that went into getting you the right. So the two of them are Universalists, Judith Sargent Murray and Mary Livermore, top and the bottom there. And two are Unitarians, Margaret Fuller and Lucy Stone. And they were all instrumental in this major paradigm shift. So, how many of you knew these names before you came here today, all four of them? I saw one hand raised. Two, three. Okay, good for you. Well, by the time you leave, hopefully you'll all be able to raise your hands. For too long, our understanding of religious and social history has been limited by focusing only on the lives and work of men. Women, however, were often the ones to activate and demonstrate the values of our faith, such as freedom, tolerance, acceptance of diversity, and individual rights. They translated liberal theology into real work to promote justice in the world. Their faith gave them the courage to rise up against the tide of their times to make the world a better place. Judah Sargent was born in 1751 in Gloucester, and as you've heard, she came from a pretty well-off family. And you can go to Gloucester, you can visit her house, you can see the church that she founded. How many of you have been to Gloucester and seen to visited these things? Good. Good for you. Well, it's a great place to go. And it's nice that there's actually a presence there still of Judah Sargent Murray. She just, you know, was, as you heard in the story earlier, just really was frustrated by the fact that she was deprived from learning. And she didn't even try to go to Harvard. I mean, it was no thought of that. Harvard wasn't open to women until it actually didn't open to women until way late. Harvard Divinity School, the school I graduated from, didn't allow women in until 1950. And Harvard finally did create Radcliffe, but, you know, it was a separate school for girls and very good school. But nevertheless, Judith really was one of those pioneers who, where did she get those ideas from? Partly from her reading that she did, and partly from being introduced when she was a teenager to Universalism and coming to know John Murray. Now, when she met John Murray, she was already married. But she knew that she sensed a real spiritual teacher in him. And she wrote him letters. And this would have been considered somewhat unusual for a woman to write a man a letter when she was married to another man. So she said, "I am not much accustomed to writing letters, especially to your sex. But if there be neither male nor female in the Emmanuel you promulgate, we may surely and with the strictest propriety mingle souls upon paper." She was a very elegant writer, and one of the great things that has really brought her out in today's world is that she wrote extensive letters to everybody. Famous people, John Adams, George Washington, Martha Washington, Abigail Adams, all sorts of famous people, and she copied every letter she wrote into these letter books. And for many, many years, they were thought to have been destroyed. And a UU minister, Gordon Gibson, found them in Natchez, Mississippi, which is where she moved at the end of her life. And they're like a stack of books. They have now all been put on microfilm and are available and are slowly being brought out, transcribed and brought out. So she wrote, as you heard in the story, one of the first explanations of what children's religious education should be like. And so I want to read you. Her language is very 18th century. So, but I really love this piece that she wrote about children. "If there is anything that ought for a moment to take the place of those exquisite sensations which we boastfully term peculiarly feminine, it is surely a sacred attention to those interests that are crowned with immortality. Whatever is essential to the ethereal spark which animates these transient tenements will exist when the distinction of male and female shall be forever absorbed." Then this was in a book about religious education, because she was really, this is her advocating for girls and boys to be treated the same in education, which just wasn't even being done anywhere. The story also mentioned that she published the first essay on women's rights, and it was published in Massachusetts Magazine in 1790, not 1970, of course, 1790. And it was entitled On the Equality of the Sexes. Now, this book was This essay, of course, she wrote under a pen name, Constancia, which everyone assumed was written by a man. So she went on to write many other essays, but because she published it and it was written by Constancia, her husband at one point, she didn't tell her husband she was doing this. And so her husband, who was by then John Murray, first her other husband died, and then Judith and John got married. And her husband came and showed her the essay and said, "I think you'll be interested in this." So anyway, that's enough about Judith. I could go on and on, but as with other women that I'm introducing today, I hope you will be intrigued about them and want to know more. But I think what I'd like you to remember about Judith Sargent Murray is that she drew on her universalist faith in publicly challenging the gender norms of her day. In so doing, she set the stage for a movement that was to emerge a century later. The next woman, Margaret Fuller, was born in 1810 in Cambridge. And because she got such a great education early on, her father was very strict and determined. She was the oldest, and he was determined to educate her. And that may be partly because he was a Unitarian. So he had these ideas about equality, and also because she just took to it like crazy. She learned to read at age 3, and she started reading. He had a great library, so she was able to learn a great deal. But what really helped her articulate what she was learning was when she became friends with these men from Harvard, men like Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau and others that she got to know and who sought her out for help with their studies, because she, by that time, she had this tremendous knowledge of classical literature, and she read Italian, Latin, German, French, at least. I'm not, maybe something. And so she was able to help them with some of their understanding of this literature that was coming from Europe that was very influential and wasn't translated. So, and in talking with them, she was able to articulate ideas and help them articulate their ideas. But she knew she couldn't go to Harvard. She knew she couldn't go to college. It was very frustrating. So she started these conversations. And the conversations were very important to a whole nother generation of women who learned to articulate ideas, learned to read material and digest it and understand it and make new ideas out of it. So she's very important for that sharing of her knowledge with others and encouraging women to be able to articulate their ideas. Her house is in Cambridge, and it still exists. It's a neighborhood house now. It's called the Margaret Fuller Neighborhood House in Cambridgeport, Central Square area. And you can go there. You can just walk in and say you want to see Margaret Fuller's house, and there's a lot of activity there. And there's the certain main rooms that still you can imagine what it was like then. It's worth going to. Now, Margaret was part of the Transcendentalist school circle, and she became the first editor of the journal, The Dial. And so she was part of actually initiating the first new major philosophical and spiritual movement in America. And at the end of the service, we're going to sing a hymn that is based on words that Margaret Fuller wrote, and it really is a great explanation of Transcendentalism. If you were never clear about what Transcendentalism was or is, this hymn will give you all you need to know, and you have a copy of it you get to take home. So her most famous book was Woman in the 19th Century, and that book became sort of the Bible of the women's suffrage movement. So these two women, Judith Sargent Murray and Margaret Fuller, were real trailblazers of ideas, and their primary venues were writing and teaching. They paved the way for others who used their ideas as foundations for women's suffrage. So our next two women were among the great organizers and public speakers of the suffrage and other social reform movements. Mary Livermore questioned the beliefs and practices of Orthodox Christianity, and so did Lucy Stone. They both were not raised in the faith, but they early on, before they'd ever heard of Unitarianism or Universalism, were questioning the beliefs of the more conservative Christianity that they were raised in. And many you use today did the same thing. Somewhere along, anybody here in that, where you questioned at an early age whatever it was you were brought up in? Yeah. So these women are part of that tradition. Lucy was so determined to go to college that she started teaching at age 15. So she was 25 when she finally got to go to college. But she was very upset because as a school teacher, she didn't get paid as much as the men did. She probably could have gotten to college a lot faster if they'd paid her what they were paying men who did exactly the same job. So she was really aware of this discrepancy all along. But her her actions, both in speaking about women's rights, and everywhere she went, she would sit down with a group of women and help them get organized and try to get them to start something else and something in their community to work on women's rights there. And she also wrote a lot of pamphlets that helped women get organized. She was really a prime organizer. And her name was Lucy Stone when she was born. And she married a Unitarian, Henry Blackwell. And in their wedding ceremony, which was, of course, performed by a Unitarian minister, they read a protest against the laws about women. And she kept her own name. And there actually was a Lucy Stoner Society that grew up. Anybody ever heard of the Lucy Stoner Society? Well, I actually met some women about 20 years ago in Brookfield who were part of the Lucy Stoner Society. And these were women who, when it wasn't at all traditional, kept their own names when they got married. So, and then Mary Livermore is actually, I think Mary Livermore is my personal favorite. Universalist, born in Boston, and she was the only one of these women who experienced slavery firsthand. And so for her, the abolitionist movement and the women's rights movement were one and the same. They were related. And in fact, when she started her public speaking career, she would be trying to talk about both of them in the same speech. And the people weren't quite ready for that. The organizers who were putting on the speech, they said, well, you can talk about women's rights on these days and abolition on these days. So the two movements were not yet together. But I always thought it was fascinating, and I never have really had an explanation by when she and Daniel came back from Chicago to live in the Boston area. He was going to serve a church in Hingham, but they moved to Melrose. Not exactly close, right? But it was a very good place on the train line, so she could get to all the places she was going to go to give speeches. So, and that house still exists, but it's a family bought it. I actually tried to buy it. I tried to get some people together to buy that house when it was for sale in the 90s. But there is a plaque on it. It's on Emerson Street, which is the same street the UU Church is on, just down a block or so from there. So the fact that she was so prolific in her speaking and all over the country, I just think is totally amazing. One of her speeches called What Shall We Do With Our Daughters, she gave 800 times. And in it, she challenged people to think about the future for the young women in their care. and of course advocated for full education. And one of the reasons she thought girls needed to be educated was she thought they needed to be prepared to support themselves and live independent lives if they so chose. And she chided her audiences for their, quote, culpability in neglecting to give their daughters some knowledge of business affairs. With utter indifference, she said, girls are allowed to grow to womanhood unfamiliar with the most ordinary forms of business transactions. Guess what, folks? That still happens today. So all you young ones that are here, learn about money, learn how to take care of money, learn what how to deal with it, and get some for yourself. Just in case. So these four women and many others were inspired and empowered by their Unitarian and Universalist faith to step beyond their comfort zones and speak out for what they believed was right. We are fortunate to have such women standing before us as part of our UU heritage. And as we come to know them, they can be role models for us as we seek to make a difference in the world. We are inheritors of a great tradition of social change. As much as we are the inheritors of this church building and its resources. As such, we have a responsibility to reincarnate the essence of our faith in the context of the challenges of our times, to blend our efforts with those of the past, to continue the living stream of Unitarian Universalism. UU Minister Keith Goheen writes, "We study history so that those who have labored before us will not have done so vainly. We do so it so their work may now be mingled with ours, and it will offer that together, their work and ours, will offer Unitarian Universalism's redemptive power to those who follow us." In order for our understanding of history to be complete, it must include women. We need all our history, because the past is what we think with. You've heard the saying that what you don't know can't hurt you. I actually don't think that's true. Actually, what you don't know might be the very information and inspiration you need to survive and to grow. Not knowing the past can hurt us, because it can deprive us from the strength that we may need in our lives. So I encourage you to learn about the history of all of our Unitarian Universalists. Make the world better were the last words that were said by Lucy Stone. I believe that's what we all want to do. And I, for one, am grateful for having discovered these women who led the way. May they inspire you as well to continue the work of making a better world. Thank you. The closing words are from 19th century astronomer Maria Mitchell, another Massachusetts Unitarian woman. "Small as is our whole system, compared with the infinitude of creation, brief as is our life, compared with the cycles of time, we are so tethered to all by the beautiful dependencies of law that not only the sparrow's fall is to be felt to the outermost bound, but the vibrations set in motion by the words that we utter reach through all space, and the tremor is felt through all time."